The reading today is taken from John chapter 19, verses 1 to 16. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him, and the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God." When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave no answer. So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greatest sin." From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." They cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he delivered him over to them to be crucified.
Thank you, Jason, and hello everybody from me as well. It's a very exciting Sunday for us. I mean, not only was this morning exciting because we had a whole crowd of people gathering physically, but we have now a whole crowd gathering electronically. And I wonder whether you put the two together. It might be one of our biggest ever Sundays. So welcome. Great to see you. I'm going to lead us in prayer just before we come to God's word. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for our growing church. And thank you for the way that we've been able to stay connected through Zoom. And thank you for gathering us today now. And we pray that you'd help us to listen carefully to your voice as you address us. And by the Holy Spirit, Lord, would you strengthen our faith for Jesus' sake. Amen. Today we're addressing the question, you'll see on the order of service if you have it, if Christianity is true, why doesn't everyone believe? And I wonder if that's ever a question that you've asked yourself or pondered, or more importantly, if it's a question that's ever unsettled you as people who, if you're Christians here today, I guess not everyone will be, but if you're Christians watching this or participating in this service, then you're in a minority. And I wonder if that's ever troubled you. Or if you're watching this and you're not a Christian, I wonder whether one of your reasons for dismissing Jesus is that you prefer to be in the majority. It's true that Christianity is not universally accepted, and certainly in our culture, it's not. And that might be a difficult thing because the psychologists tell us that, and we know this anyway, but the psychologists can confirm that we get very influenced by peer pressure and by group opinion. And you may know that before I became a vicar, I did some research in neuroscience and psychology. And so I looked up some of the academic stuff on this, and it only tells us what we already know, but it's quite fun. So there's two studies. One study by a couple of apparently French scientists, that they sound Italian. Their names are Moscovici and Zavalloni. But these researchers asked people about their opinions of the French president. And secondly, they asked people about their attitudes towards Americans. And then they put people in groups. Some groups were random, so it had all the different opinions in them. But some groups had more people who tended to have agreed with each other about them. They got them to discuss the question, what do you think of the French president and what do you think about Americans? And it turned out that if you were in a group where everybody else thought the same as you, then by the end of your group discussion, you thought the same thing much more strongly and even violently. So if you thought the French president was quite good news, then once you were in the group with other French president lovers, then you really thought the French president was a, you know, was some kind of saint figure, a hero figure. And if you didn't like Americans very much, if you were in a group with other people who didn't like Americans very much, remember these are French people in the study, then by the end of it, you really hated Americans. Because it turns out there's a kind of echo chamber effect, whereas being with people who have the same opinion as you tends to make you believe what you believe more strongly. And that's therefore difficult for a minority group, because we're in a group of people that don't think the same as us. And it makes you think what you believe more tentatively, what makes you more insecure about your beliefs. And you'll know this is one of the controversies behind social media, because Facebook tends to show you on your Facebook feed the opinions of others who think the same as you do. And then you think that the whole world thinks as you do, and then you think it more strongly. It might be that you've got a very Christian group of friends on Facebook, and so by looking at your Facebook feed, you'd imagine that everybody followed Jesus. But of course, that isn't the case. And if we tune into media like the BBC, or we discuss it at work or in our university, we discover that we're in the minority. And being in the minority, it tends to silence us. We like to follow the crowd. Here's just one more psychological study for fun, because this one is the most fun. This is another guy. I think this guy really is an Italian, called Cialdini. And he measured the effect of group opinion by telling people as they entered Arizona's Petrified Forest National Park. So this is a national park where trees have been turned into fossils of trees. And they put up these signs saying, "Your heritage is being vandalized every day by theft losses of petrified wood of 14 tons a year, mostly a small piece at a time." And then they measured the effect on putting this sign up or taking this sign away. And it turned out that the sign warning people about the theft of wood actually increased the theft of wood, because people were going through this national park thinking, well, if 14 tons a year are being stolen, it's obviously quite normal to steal it. So I'll have a little souvenir of my own. And they pick up a little bit of fossilized tree to put in their pocket. If everyone's doing it, then I'll do it. If everyone believes it, I'll believe it. And if everyone doesn't believe it, well, I'll find it quite hard to believe it. Or at least I'll find it quite hard to talk about the fact that I believe it. And we did a survey, or say we, I mean, our ministry trainees did a survey outside the Macmillan Hall of Residence for Trinity Laban students just a couple of weeks ago. And they had two big dustbins, and you were handed a ball, and you could vote by throwing the ball into one dustbin or the other. And the question was, does God have anything to do with coronavirus? And, you know, people voted and got engaged in conversation. But the idea was to try and find a topical point of conversation that people might have an opinion on, and it wasn't much to lose. But let's imagine you were to ask a more front-footed question. Do you believe that Jesus is the rightful king of everybody? I mean, not only would you get more no's, but it would be difficult to have the courage to ask the question of someone in the street. How dare you impose your weird belief about Jesus on me? And it might be, if you're a Christian, that kind of reaction, it silences us. It makes us maybe even doubt our own position. And I think that's one of the reasons that John has given us in his account of Jesus' life such a focus on Jesus' trial. Not only that we'd have our own confidence in Jesus strengthened, but so that we would understand why it is that he is not universally popular. And we would be urged by John not to follow the crowd when it comes to Jesus. John wants us to increase our trust in Jesus and to decrease our trust in other human beings. If you've got the outline, the order of service there, you'll see point number one, Jesus is innocent. Point number three, human beings are guilty. Andrew Latimer, actually last week, if you were here, gave a great illustration of this. as Jesus goes on trial, actually it's humanity that are on trial. And the illustration he gave, to the risk of embarrassing her one all over again, was to say that Annabelle Holloway's biscuits are indisputably the best biscuits in Greenwich. And that's just a fact. It's not really a subjective thing. It's just true. And if you don't like Annabelle Holloway's biscuits, you sit in judgment over them and find them wanting. That actually doesn't tell us anything about Annabelle's biscuits. We already know they're brilliant. It just tells us that you've got coronavirus because you must have lost your sense of taste. And therefore, it's just as well that you're on the online Zoom. The judgment doesn't tell you anything about Jesus. It tells you about the people who are doing the judging. It turns out they're the ones who are really in the dock. And that's what we're going to see as we look through this next part of the court case in chapter 19. Jesus is before Pilate. And the first thing I want us to notice is that there is no question but that Jesus is innocent. And Pilate knows it. Actually, it comes three times in our passage, or just before our passage, and then in our passage. So we find it in chapter 18, verse 38. Pilate went back outside to the Jews and told them, "I find no guilt in him. He's innocent." And then he goes back in and comes out again in verse 4 of chapter 19. "See, I'm bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him." And then one more time in verse 6. "When the chief priests and the officers saw Jesus, they cried out, 'Crucify him, crucify him.' Pilate said to them, 'Take him yourself and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him.'" I don't know the significance of it coming three times. I guess maybe it's meant to mirror Peter's three denials of Jesus in the earlier chapter. But now Pilate's threefold statement, he is not guilty. Now, you need to understand that Pilate is no particular friend of Christians or of Jesus. He is a Roman governor who's responsible for controlling the Jewish people in this troublesome and problematic corner of the empire. And here he is just doing his job, trying to see a court case through. I guess you might say he's quite objective in it, and his conclusion is absolutely clear. He's not guilty. In fact, Pilate's so clear he's not guilty that he's very reluctant to take things further. "You crucify him," he says, "because in my court, there is no crime." Now, that is an amazing verdict for someone like this to reach. I mean, he's trying to find a reason to fault Jesus. It would make his life a lot easier if he could find something. He can find nothing. I mean, just imagine that for a moment. You wouldn't have to stay with me for very long. Maybe a week would be enough before you could have a whole list of things where I come short of God's standards. But Jesus, even his closest friends who spent 3 years with him, could find nothing. And a hostile Roman governor can find nothing. Jesus is innocent. Which makes it quite odd that in this court case, he ends up being condemned. If the judge knows he's innocent, how come in the end he's handed the death sentence? Well, it is because, point number two, the Jews would not accept that he was innocent. They wouldn't accept the verdict. It's a bizarre scene. Let's imagine it's a courtroom. And I see we have our friend, the High Court judge, here with us. Hello, Jeremy. Nice to see you and watching this. I don't suppose this has ever happened in your courtroom. Maybe it has. Where the judge is, well, the jury will come in with the verdict, not guilty. And the judge sums up and says, "Have we seen this guy's not guilty?" But then people in the public gallery begin to scream for the death sentence. And they cry, "Kill him, kill him, kill him, kill him." And they're chanting and chanting. And then in the end, the judge says, "Oh, well, okay then, if you insist." The verdict's clear. Innocent, but he gets the sentence anyway, just because the crowd will not stop insisting on getting his blood. What is their problem? Is it that they think that Pilate has somehow missed his crime? Pilate, you don't find any guilt in him, but we found something. Well, yeah, on the surface of it, that is why. So look at verse 7. The Jews answered Pilate. So Pilate says he finds no guilt in him. Well, they say, well, we do. The Jews answered Pilate, we have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he's made himself the Son of God. Now, they don't specify which law it is, but I guess it's the blasphemy law or the third commandment, maybe not taking the name of the Lord our God in vain, something like that. But they decide that Jesus has broken this and therefore he must die. But their charge kind of begs the question, doesn't it? They say, we've got a law. He must die because he called himself, or he made himself, the Son of God. But the question is, well, is he right? Because if Jesus is the Son of God, and all the evidence points that way, then how can he be guilty for saying who he really is? It would be like somebody arresting me for impersonating a cleric. And if that's actually against the law, you're not allowed to impersonate a policeman, are you? But they say, you've been impersonating a vicar. And I say, well, my defense is, I am a vicar. Or even more bizarre, wouldn't it, would be if I was on trial for identity theft. And they say, look, you're on charge because you're impersonating Andrew Satch. We even found that you have a passport in the name of Andrew Satch that you must have somehow forged. And my defense would be, I am Andrew Satch. It'd be bizarre to accuse me of being guilty for just saying who I really am. Well, they have the same kind of logic. This man said he was the Son of God, but they don't pause to ask whether or not he actually was the Son of God. Well, my suggestion is that is the problem. The evidence is that Jesus is God's king, and the overwhelming evidence, the evidence of Jesus' miracles, raising the dead, opening the eyes of the blind, feeding 5,000 people with a few bread rolls. It's just that they won't stomach it. They don't like that claim. Because when Jesus is the Son of God, it means he treads on their toes much too much. And I think that's the same as the reason that people today don't like Jesus. You see, if Jesus was only offering to give us good advice, to be an inspirational teacher, well, we've got a lot of time for that, haven't we? I mean, in our society, people look for inspirational teachers. You go to Waterstones, you can find all sorts of gurus and helps. And people would say, yeah, it's fair enough. Jesus is one of them. I mean, in the last 3,000 years of human history, he'd be one of the top names for people who changed the world. I've got no problem with you getting inspiration from Jesus. People don't even mind Jesus, the miracle worker. I mean, goodness knows, we could do with a miracle right now, couldn't we? And all sorts of people believe in miracles. And if Jesus can offer miracles, well, great. Well, why don't you pray to Jesus then to end the coronavirus pandemic? And of course, you know, I might pray to Allah, and somebody else might pray to one of the Hindu gods, and other people will trust science to try and find a vaccine. But I don't mind if you want to go the religious route. That's okay. Each person to themselves. People don't mind Jesus, the miracle worker. But people don't like Jesus, the Son of God. Because if he's the Son of God, he's got a claim on me. If he's going to be the king and I'm going to be under his jurisdiction, he might start telling me what I ought to do and how I ought to live and impinging on my decisions. And I don't want that. And that is the thing that they can't stomach. They won't accept it, that he is the king, even though the evidence is very strong. In fact, John says halfway through his gospel in chapter 12, after all these miracles that many of these people have seen and they've investigated and found that the evidence is compelling. And John, the gospel writer, says, even though Jesus had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him. And it makes you realize it's something other than lack of evidence that's their problem. I suggest they cannot stomach the idea that here is somebody who wants to rule their lives. It's the same reason that we reject him today. I just want to do a little aside here on the question of anti-Semitism. So this is the Jews are rejecting Jesus. And so does that mean that we ought to hate Jewish people, particularly because they killed the Messiah? I've rather liked the little poem. I think it was a bit of graffiti, maybe someone sprayed somewhere. How odd of God to choose the Jews. And then somebody had added to the bottom of the graffiti, but not as odd as those who choose a Jewish God and scorn the Jews, which I think is a great comeback, isn't it? I mean, it'd be ridiculous to be an anti-Semite on the basis of this chapter, because you just got to remember that John, who's writing it, is a Jew. And Jesus, who is the Son of God, is a Jew. And all of Jesus' disciples are Jewish. And so is the whole of the early church. This isn't a book against Jews. This is a book that exposes humanity for rejecting God. But maybe it is the most shocking that the Jewish people did. They're only doing what all of us do. But it's extra shocking that they did, because this is the group of people that ought to have known that Jesus was the Son of God. They had scriptures prophesying the coming of the Son of God. They were expecting the miracles that they then saw of Jesus, the Son of God. And yet even this group of people would not accept him. John actually gives a little intro in his first chapter in the prologue to John, where he captures the shock of this. And John writes this: he was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world didn't know him. And you're supposed to think, what? I mean, there's something badly wrong there, isn't it? That he is the creator of all of us, and yet we don't recognize our own creator. And then John goes on, he came to his own people, meaning the Jewish people, the chosen people. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. And you're supposed to be thinking, what? The people who spent their lives waiting for the Messiah rejected the Messiah. That is supposed to be shocking, but it tells us about ourselves. We don't want a king. It's pretty obvious he is the king. The evidence is overwhelming. But every time they realize he is, every time he opens his mouth and explains that he is God come to earth, they pick up stones to stone him. It happens in chapter 5, happens again in chapter 10. And now they've almost got him, but this time by harnessing the power of the Roman state to kill him. It doesn't tell us anything about Jesus, their rejection. He's innocent. Pilate knows he's innocent. It just tells us something about them. They will not accept him. And Pilate, he kind of knows something is wrong. I put point number three, they are guilty. And really, all of them are guilty. Pilate is guilty. Pilate says very clearly he's innocent. Back in chapter 18, verse 39. So why then in chapter 19, verse 1, does he have Jesus flogged? And that is the cowardly action of a governor who just wants to pacify the crowd rather than the courage of somebody who wants to bring justice. Can you imagine that in a courtroom? The jury says not guilty, the judge says not guilty, but you know, go and beat him up anyway, because I know that will be popular. I mean, it's extraordinary miscarriage of justice by this weak man. I'm not saying Pilate is innocent, but Pilate has the is haunted by his conscience. He begins to realize that not only is Jesus innocent, but maybe also Jesus is a king. Just look at verse 7. The Jews said, we have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he's made himself the Son of God. When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He just has this sense that maybe he's got out of his depth. What if this really is God come to earth? What if this really is an innocent man that I'm about to kill? But then so disappointingly, at the end, he says, well, go on then. Do your bit. I won't do it because, you know, I want to sort of try and distance myself from it. But if you want to kill him, go and kill him. I won't stand in your way. Pilate is guilty, but the Jews, they're the more guilty. Verse 11. Jesus says to Pilate, you've got no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. I don't know whether he means Caiaphas, the high priest. I mean, Caiaphas ought to have known, the man who studied the Old Testament scriptures every single Saturday in the synagogue, and now faced with God himself, he kills him. He ought to have known. Or maybe he means Judas Iscariot, one of Jesus' 12 apostles, who spent the last 3 years with Jesus, seeing his miracles, hearing his teaching. He really ought to have known. The idea here is that the more you know about God, the more your culpability for rejecting God. And what a shock it is that those who are very religious, those who know quite a lot about God, are the ones who most reject him. And they reject him in the most appalling way. And it's the most hypocritical way. What's their reason for being annoyed about Jesus? Oh, he's a blasphemer, they say. You see, because we only worship the one God. The only king we recognize is our God in heaven. And this guy says he's a king. We can't accept that. But then by the end of the chapter, by the end of the passage, they are prepared, in order to force Pilate's hand, to declare themselves worshippers, servants of Caesar. It's a good argument, isn't it? Because they know Pilate is the representative of the Roman emperor. And so they just say, oh, well, this man is against Caesar. So you've got to arrest him now, haven't you? You've got to kill him now, Pilate. You've got to do your job. He's an insurrectionist. He's against the Roman state. So come on, do the rest. You see, it's a clever and political move, but it's an extraordinary move for Jewish people who did not recognize the Roman emperor, who the only king that they said they knew was God. And yet here they are prepared to say, we have no king but Caesar. And here's the idea here, that if you reject Jesus, you find yourself serving all sorts of other tyrants who are nowhere near as loving or truthful or compassionate as him. In his place, it's not a vacuum, but they're willing to perjure themselves, to blaspheme themselves, to insult their own nation. They are guilty. And so at the end of it, John's court case, we're meant to have our confidence in Jesus increased and our confidence in humans who are making the verdict undermined. I've got three reactions by way of application. I hope that we have some of these reactions, maybe even all three of these reactions. The first one is shock. We ought to be shocked that Jesus is rejected. And I just wonder whether we haven't got quite used to it. It's just quite common. You know, you say to somebody, oh, would you like to come and hear about Jesus? They say, oh, no, thanks. We go, oh, no, of course. I'm so sorry to bother you, because of course you wouldn't want to, would you? Because why should you? Rather than thinking, but this is the Son of God. This is the one who made you, who created you. And you're not interested in him. I mean, that is offensively wrong. Shockingly wrong. We got kind of used to it, that rejection. Or maybe you've got a friend or a family member who just makes excuses for keeping Jesus at arm's length, and you kind of believe their excuses. They say, look, I'm doing my best, and you know, if I'm trying to investigate, and if only God made himself a bit more obvious, then I really, really would believe, I promise. And we go, oh, yeah, fair enough, you're just being reasonable, and God hasn't really made a clear enough case for you, has he? We can't read this and come to that conclusion. In the face of Jesus' innocence, human beings cry for his blood. It is rejection. And that is a shocking thing. We ought not to be satisfied that we live in a culture where Jesus is not honored, or where we watch media where Jesus is marginalized. But the trouble is, we're affected by public opinion, and we fear they might be right, and so we keep quiet. Shock. Or maybe our reaction is fear, like Pilate was afraid. And I guess this might particularly be anyone here who is conscious that they themselves are on the wrong side of Jesus. Maybe because you're not a Christian, or maybe you claim to be a Christian, but you know you're not following him as Son of God. And Pilate is haunted by his conscience. From that point on, we read he was even more afraid. But it's not enough to make him do the right thing. It just makes him uneasy. And he's such a coward that he still kind of carries on following the crowd. It might be that you're aware of the tug of your conscience that says to you that maybe there's something wrong here. Maybe this really does involve my creator speaking to me. Maybe Jesus really is the rightful king. And can I say to you that if your conscience is nagging you, don't silence it. Our consciences are put there for a reason. They're a gift of God to guide us in this world. And don't suppress that feeling if you're rejecting Jesus and you feel uneasy, that fear. And then finally, maybe we feel, I think this is John's aim, that we feel an increased trust. Jesus is right here, even though humanity is wrong. Jesus is true, even though it might be a minority who thinks so. Because at the end of the day, we trust Pilate's verdict. He is innocent. And we totally distrust the crowd calling out for his blood. Jesus is decreasingly popular, I guess, in the Western world. And not globally. Jesus' popularity in China, in India, in Africa, hugely rising. But in the West, it's waning. And we can be so susceptible to public opinion, to the verdict of everybody else. And John is saying, don't trust their verdict. And Jesus is right. And humanity is wrong. We're going to take a brief pause and then we're going to pray together.